Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moskowain. Hardly a day goes by without news of tensions rising in the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has been escalating its threats to attack South Korea and its ally, the United States. And in response, the U.S. has stepped up its show of force in the region, shifting a guided missile destroyer into the area and flying F-2 stealth fighter jets to South Korea. And that's in addition to the B-52 bombers and the B-2 stealth bombers that flew over the area last week. What are we to make of this? How much is rhetoric and how much is real threat? Is North Korea's young new leader, Kim Jong-un, more volatile than his ancestors? And what is life like for the people of North Korea in the midst of all this? We'll hear about life in the isolated country a little later on, but we begin with a closer look at the dynamic shaping North Korea's view on the rest of the world and what could happen from here. Our guest is Joel Witt, an expert on North Korea who spent 15 years working at the State Department. Joel is currently a visiting scholar at the U.S. Korea Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and there he manages the school's program 38north.org, which provides informed and timely analysis of events in and around North Korea online. Joel, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks.
Well, there's been so much news just the last few days coming out of North Korea. We talked about the show of military might in response to, you know, threats that North Korea would reopen its nuclear facilities. We've seen North Korea's leader with a map showing U.S. targets that it would attack. And now we hear this morning about not shutting down, but at least banning South Korean workers from that industrial complex that's right on the border that's so critical to North Korea. So are we talking about normal North Korean saber rattling, or is this something much more?
Well, I would say that maybe 80% of this is just the normal North Korean behavior, given the kind of situation they find themselves in today. And by that I mean that, as everyone knows, North Korea conducted a partially successful long-range missile test in December, and it conducted its third nuclear test in February. And in response to that, the United States sought and got UN sanctions. And on top of that, there's a joint U.S.-South Korean military exercise going on right now in South Korea. So in this kind of situation, the North Koreans kind of go to their playbook and pull out the plays they use when they find themselves under pressure from the United States and the international community. And so many of the plays you're seeing are from that playbook. They've done it before, and they're doing it again. For example, the news this morning about the slowdown of allowing South Koreans into the Kaesong industrial zone, they did in 2009 a couple of times when there was an ongoing U.S.-South Korean military exercise. The heightened rhetoric, the threats that they're making is perfectly normal when the United Nations imposes new sanctions on North Korea. So a lot of this is very predictable. What seems a little bit different is the level of rhetoric is that sometimes very shrill, maybe more shrill than it's been in the past. But, you know, I don't know what you can read into that. There are any number of explanations. And, you know, the danger when you're dealing with North Korea is people tend to analyze things in much finer ways than they're able to, given the available information. And I'm not really willing to do that.
Hmm. Joel, what do you think the rest of the motivation is? You know, you talked about the fact that there are sanctions now that they're upset about. They're upset about the display of military might that's going on between the U.S. and South Korea in that area. What about just the economics of all of this? How much is that a motivating factor? You know, we've seen this before where North Korea has issued these kinds of threats ultimately to get us to the table to talk about aid and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You know, I've never been one. I have to disagree with that characterization, although I know where it's coming from. Lots of people say that. But I've never been one to believe that what North Korea is doing in the security area is designed to extract economic assistance from the outside world. What North Korea does in the security area is based on its own perceptions of what its national security requires. So, for example, North Korea's weapons of mass destruction programs, its nuclear weapons program, its missile program, are being pursued because of a threat, their perception of a threat from the United States, South Korea, Japan, and others. Having said all that, you know, sometimes things change. And so, for example, when I was in the State Department starting in 1993, which now is quite a while ago, you know, North Korea had a really serious nuclear weapons program. And, you know, sitting at my desk at the State Department, looking at our intelligence estimates, they were telling us that by the end of the decade, North Korea might have as many as 100 nuclear weapons, which was pretty scary. But what happened was the geopolitics shifted. North Korea lost its allies, the Soviet Union, and China was trying to improve its relations with South Korea. And the North Koreans made a political decision that they needed to improve relations with the United States. And in that context, they were willing to, you know, give up their nuclear weapons program. And of course, they wanted to get something in return, which was economic assistance. So, you know, political shifts can sometimes result in a change in North Korea's direction. And as part of that change, of course, they're going to be seeking compensation.
Is some of this, too, Kim Jong-un's desire to establish himself as a strong military leader?
Well, yeah, I think that's part of what's going on here, although I would note that in the first year, he's only been in power for a year, and he's a young guy. You know, he's less than 30 years old. I forgot if he's 27, 28. He's a young guy, but over the past year, it's very interesting what he's been doing. You know, his father put in place a support system for his son when his son would take over. And by that I mean he put in place a lot of reliable people in important jobs, and a lot of people his father felt would support him when the young man took over. And many of those jobs were in the military. They were senior military jobs. So lo and behold, his father dies and he takes over. And over the past year, he's been replacing all these military men his father put in place with his own men. So, to me, that shows a certain degree of confidence in his ability to stay in control, to deal with the military, and to rule his country. So, you know, I wouldn't exaggerate what some people say, which is he has to, you know, kind of kowtow to the military. I think he has to strike a certain posture when faced with outside threats, which is a posture that almost everyone in the North Korean leadership would strike anyway. But, you know, that doesn't mean he's a tool of the North Korean military, and indeed what's happened over the past year suggests he isn't a tool of them. They're a tool of his.
Hmm. Well, what do we know about him, Joel? It doesn't seem that we have very much information about him.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, you can read all the speculation about him, but we know very little about him. We know, you know, who his mother was. We know he went to school in Switzerland for a while. You know, we know that he's a big basketball fan because Dennis Rodman just visited there, and evidently they went out and partied a lot. And that's not you know, that's not surprising because his father was a big basketball fan, too. I mean, his father was a real Michael Jordan fan, and I suspect he is also. You know, those are kind of the... And the last thing is we know he has a very pretty young wife who has also kind of been accompanying him around the country, which is a big change from his father's leadership style, and his wife may even have had a baby recently. Mm. So those are the kind of human things we know about him. But if we look at his first year in office, a lot of the predictions were young man, doesn't have experience, he's going to have problems. And in fact, the first year in office doesn't reflect that at all. He seems to really know what he's doing.
Is there reason to believe that he's more volatile than his ancestors?
I just don't know. I mean, that's something we don't know. There's speculation that because he's a young man, you know, he doesn't have a lot of experience. He may not be as cautious as his father was or his grandfather. But we just don't know. You know, we don't have enough information to really reach those kinds of conclusions. And one of the problems is, of course, no one has really met him. No one from the United States, except Dennis Rodman, has really sat down and talked with him. And, you know, when his father, Kim Jong-il, took over after Kim Il-sung died, there was lots of speculation that he's unstable, he's crazy. So there was a lot of speculation about him. But when people finally started to meet him, like the South Korean leader, Kim Dae-jung, or Secretary of State Madeleine Albright went there in 2000, I guess it was, they came away with a very different impression. You know, they came away with the impression this was a very smart guy who, of course, was very ruthless, because you have to be to rule North Korea, but certainly not crazy and certainly not unstable. So, you know, we're at the beginning of the process with this one, and no one's really met him, so we don't really know for sure.
And isn't that then what some of the alarm is about, because we really don't know?
Yeah, you know, I think the uncertainty is disturbing. And, of course, when you throw that uncertainty into the kind of situation we have now, it becomes even more disturbing, because people don't know what he's really going to do. And so I would say it's very unlikely, and it's been very unlikely for the past few months, that North Korea is going to launch a military attack. And indeed, you know, for the past 40 years, we've developed a very highly sophisticated system of intelligence that would warn us of North Korean attacks. And as far as I can tell from reading the press, there weren't any signs that anything unusual is going on in the North Korean military. So, but, you know, the uncertainty makes us nervous, and
Joel,
that's perfectly understandable.
We'll stop right there and we'll take a quick break. We are talking about North Korea and the threats that have been coming from that country in recent days, and the concern among leaders in the U.S., South Korea, and elsewhere. We'll take your calls as well at 888-477-9499 when Radio Times comes right back.
The Orthopedic and Spine Institute at Abington and Lansdale Hospital supports WHYY and uses minimally invasive surgery to help patients return to their normal routines faster. To learn more about new procedures that use smaller incisions and for patient stories, abingtonpowertoheal.org.
PIFA, a Kimmel Center production, supports WHYY and presents the choir of King's College Cambridge on Saturday, April 6th in Verizon Hall. Firmly steeped in the English choral tradition, the illustrious boys' choir celebrates the centennial of composer Benjamin Britten's birth with a program including Britten's A Hymn to the Virgin and Rejoice in the Lamb, plus choral music by Purcell, Gibbons, Bird, and Verdi. Sponsored by TD Bank. Tickets at pifa.org.
The African Film Festival is opening in New York. It celebrates its 20th year of bringing new stories and storytellers from Africa, like Ghana's Frances Bodomo, who presents her short film, Bone Shaker. We'll hear more next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscoane. We are talking about North Korea. Certainly there have been many headlines in recent days about the threats coming from the North Korean leadership and the response by the United States and South Korea in particular. We've been talking with Joel Witt, who is someone who has worked extensively on nuclear arms control, non-proliferation. I'm going to say that again. It's proliferation. That's what I'm trying to say. Joel, and North Korea issues. Joel is an expert. He's worked at the State Department for 15 years, and he's now at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Joel, welcome back. And when we left off, we were talking about a number of these issues relating to North Korea. We were talking about specifically Kim Jong-un and what we know or don't know about him and the uncertainty surrounding this situation. I want to invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. The number is 888-477-9499, 477-WHYY. Joel, give us a sense of how much damage North Korea is capable of inflicting at this point, be it on South Korea, on U.S. interests, etc.?
Well, of course, the level of damage is enormous. And the first point I'd like to make is that, and I'm sure you've heard it and others have heard it, right now North Korea cannot attack the continental United States. It just can't reach us with its long-range missiles. We don't know what the situation will be 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And they're moving down the road to trying to develop those missiles. There are a number of significant technical hurdles, and we don't know if they'll overcome them. But, you know, it's possible in 5 years they'll be able to do that. Secondly, in the near term, yes, the amount of damage they can do to South Korea is enormous, and it's been enormous, you know, for decades now. The main way they can do that is that, you know, there are thousands of artillery pieces in North Korea that are not far from the South Korean capital of Seoul, because Seoul is not far from the demilitarized zone that separates the two countries. So, you know, North Korea can do enormous damage to Seoul. And I think the level of damage has grown because South Korea has been developing for the past three decades. And now it's a modern society. If you go to South Korea, you know, it's almost like being in New York City if you're in Seoul. So the targets for North Korea have become larger and larger and richer and richer. So the level of damage there would be enormous. But on top of that, you have to think about what does North Korea's acquisition of nuclear weapons mean in terms of the level of damage right. It can inflict on its neighbors. And the obvious answer is that if it used those weapons, the level of damage would be even bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be catastrophic. So, you know, this is not a good situation.
Well, let's go to the phones. We have a number of people with questions for you. We'll start off. We'll welcome Tommy from Downingtown to Radio Times. Hi, Tommy.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you for putting this particular topic on the air today. I woke up this morning and the first thing I did was I sent an email to Ban Ki-moon. Why did I send an email to Ban Ki-moon? Because I didn't think that we had any diplomats who could handle this situation. And this is a frightened country with frightened leaders and frightened people. And it doesn't take much imagination to come up with some creative diplomacy. But it seems to me that our diplomatic corps is it's sleeping at the wheel. And I'm wondering what your guest thinks of that.
All right. Thanks for your call. Joel?
Well, you know, I didn't coax your caller to call in, but he's really struck a chord with me, because for the past 4 years I've been saying and writing articles about how the Obama administration's policy towards North Korea is going to be a failure. And today, of course, I would say it is a failure. And the reason for that is there is no creative diplomacy. I mean, it's one thing to take strong measures to contain North Korea and to defend ourselves and our allies. And I think we definitely need to be doing that. But, you know, there has to be an off-ramp for this freeway, and we haven't tried to create an off-ramp through diplomacy.
Well, Joel, our policy, we've done the strategic patience, right? That's been the policy up until this point. So
yes.
You're saying that that's not working so well.
Strategic patience, you know, I like to joke a little bit, although this is a serious situation. It's like we're conducting a massive psychological experiment on North Korea, because one of the tenets of strategic patience is that if we isolate them and contain them, it'll teach them that their bad behavior doesn't pay off, and they'll start behaving better. And in fact, that's not the case. And people with experience dealing with North Korea warned the administration in 2009 that this was not going to work. We've been warning them since about it. And quite frankly, the administration's attitude is, we have a lot of foreign policy problems. Let's keep this one off the front pages. And, you know, let's just kind of deal with it somehow in a quiet way. And the North Korea, it's just not possible to do that with North Korea, and the situation's getting a lot worse.
So what should we be doing, in your view, Joel? What would creative diplomacy look like, possibly?
Well, let me give you one off-the-wall idea that I think your caller would like, but most people wouldn't like. You know, we have a new Secretary of State. Our new Secretary of State is visiting South Korea, Japan, and China. I guess it's probably in 10 days or so. Well, why can't the new Secretary of State offer to meet with the North Korean leader, to sit down and talk, and to start a process of exploring whether there's a different path forward here? I'm not naive, and I'm not saying if we'd only do that, the North Koreans would behave like nice guys and we'll find a path forward, but we're not going to know until we engage in this kind of diplomatic activity, and we really haven't been doing that.
Do we have reason to believe that North Korea would be receptive to that?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure they'd be receptive to it or not, but the fact is we need to start trying, and we're not even trying at this point. And I find it disturbing, not just because of the situation there, but also because if you look at another crisis area, Iran, in fact, in the negotiations with the Iranians, the periodic negotiations, which may not go anywhere either, at least there's a senior U.S. government official there representing the United States, and there's the opportunity to at least talk to the Iranians. We don't even have that in this situation. And to my mind, this situation is just as, if not more serious, than the situation we have with Iran.
One more question before we go back to the phones, and that is, militarily, do we have the bandwidth to fully engage in this if we really come to crisis point? I'm thinking in light of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. Are we prepared to fully engage in this?
You know, that's an excellent question, and I don't know what the status of our war plans are, and I don't want to say too much about it, but in the past, at least, the war plan required the United States to send thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of troops to South Korea if there was an all-out war. That may have been modified over the years. I'm not quite sure, but the point you're making is right on point, because if tomorrow there was an all-out war on the Korean Peninsula, I wouldn't be surprised if we'd have serious problems meeting our obligations there.
Well, we'll go back to the phones now to Reading, Pennsylvania, and we'll welcome Liz to Radio Times. Hi, Liz.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My son lives in Seoul, and so, of course, this is on the forefront of my interest. And I'd like to ask your guest. He said that there is a likely, or there is the possibility of inflicting extensive damage on South Korea, particularly Seoul, since it is such a huge area. My question for your guest is, what does he think is the likelihood of the North attacking the South and inflicting such damage? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Liz.
Yeah, well, I can understand why she's asking that question, and what I'd like to say is that I don't see it likely that North Korea is going to launch an attack on South Korea, even in the current circumstances. I don't think it's likely. I think a lot of what we're seeing, as I said earlier, are just pages out of their playbook, and as far as I can tell from reading the newspapers, our intelligence has not detected any preparations for starting a second Korean War on the part of North Korea. So, I mean, the current situation is of concern because of the danger of miscalculation or accident. But in terms of a deliberate North Korean attack on South Korea at the moment, I don't think that's likely.
And Joel, when you talk about the danger of miscalculation, are you talking about by the United States, by South Korea perhaps? In terms of moves that North Korea might be making or threats they might be issuing?
By any of the above,
mm-hmm.
North Korea, South Korea, the United States, there's always a danger in a tense situation where there's virtually no communication between the two sides that some accident, miscalculation can kind of strike the match that sets off, you know, a bigger conflict. And I mean, we've seen that over and over again in history, and I don't need to go through all of the historical examples, but, you know, that's the big danger here. I don't think anyone is deliberately going to start a second Korean War.
We'll go back to the phones and to Center City, and we'll welcome Teresa to Radio Times. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to go back to what you're talking about on policy, and I wanted to know what your opinion is on the legacy of the Sunshine Policy, and also, do you think that the Sunshine Policy in any way could have enabled or contributed to the development of nuclear weapons in North Korea currently? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Liz. Joel?
You know, I think at the time, it sounds like your caller knows something about this history. So she might recall that at the end of the Sunshine Policy, a lot of South Koreans were critical of the policy, largely because part of it was basically bribing the North Koreans for senior meetings or for cooperative activities. I mean, large sums of money switched hands that helped set up at least the first North-South summit that was held in, I guess it was 1998. So there was a lot of criticism of the Sunshine Policy because of that. And that's, of course, perfectly understandable. But if you step back for a minute and look at the broader effects of the Sunshine Policy and compare them to the results of the past 5 years of the Lee Myung-bak government in South Korea, which is much more conservative and basically ended the Sunshine Policy. If you contrast the two, I think the conclusion is the Sunshine Policy was probably the better way to go, because at least it created patterns of cooperation between North and South Korea. Each side had a stake in that cooperation. And we didn't have the kinds of tensions and the kinds of incidents that we're experiencing now and that we have been experiencing in South Korea since at least 2010. So my overall evaluation of the Sunshine Policy is that there were problems with it, but basically that was the right way to go.
Joel, a couple quick things I'd like to try to squeeze in because we only have you with us for just a few more minutes. But we talked about food aid just a little while ago about, you know, is this ultimately about the North Korean economy and the need for some assistance from us and a way to sort of get us back to the table? You said not so much, but is there not a need for that in North Korea? I mean, our understanding here, at least, is that the economy is not so good and that there is a need for some sort of aid from abroad.
Yes, there is need for aid from abroad, but there happens to be a very big country right on North Korea's border that is giving them significant assistance, and that's China. You know, on top of that, North Korea, despite the myth that North Korea is a hermit kingdom, it isn't a hermit kingdom. There are thousands of North Koreans overseas. For example, there are North Korean workers in Kuwait. They're in Mongolia. They're in Russia. They're earning hard currency. A lot of it goes home. But that's just the tip of the iceberg of their ties around the world. Those ties are not with the United States, although some of them are with our European allies, and even to some degree with South Korea, they get financial assistance via the economic cooperation in that the caisson zone. So when we say they need outside assistance, they're getting the assistance, and in fact, assistance from the United States is no longer that important, although it'd be good to have it, but it's not critical as far as they're concerned. And in fact, the system, the situation inside North Korea has been improving over the past few years because of the economic assistance. So when I was there at the end of 2010, it was very different from my earlier visits. I was in the capital city, and you could see there was a new vitality, and everything had been spruced up. And you could even tell North Koreans had disposable income because you would go to the zoo and find lots of candy wrappers on the ground. So the picture, what is the reality inside North Korea is very different from the picture that's often painted in the media.
Well, in our final 60 seconds, Joel, tell us what we ought to be watching for in the coming days and weeks as it relates to the Korean Peninsula.
Well, I think one thing I hope will happen is when the current U.S. South Korean military exercise winds down and is over, and I guess that's in the next few days, I think things will start to calm down a little bit. And that's, of course, everyone wants that to happen. But we also have to understand that if we have any more provocations, like the kinds that North Korea launched in 2010 when they sunk a South Korean naval vessel and fired some artillery shells at a South Korean island, we could be in another very difficult situation. So we need to be thinking about how to get out of this cycle that we're in, and this returns to the point made by your earlier caller. We need to rev up our diplomatic effort.
Joel Witt, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times. We'll keep an eye on 38north.org for more information about North Korea. Pleasure having you with us.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
And when we come back, we will get a rare glimpse inside North Korea. What is life like there? We'll talk with someone who has interviewed many, many North Korean refugees when Radio Times comes right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company and its revival of Permanent Collection. Inspired by the Barnes Museum, this gripping drama follows the newly hired executive director whose ideas for changing the Permanent Collection ignite a racially charged controversy. Permanent Collection runs April 5th through May 5th. For tickets, 215-568-8079 or online at interacttheater.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Are some liberals coming around to the NRA's position that enforcing gun laws might be the best way to control gun violence? Also, lessons from Sally Krawcheck, the woman who rose to the top of Wall Street twice and was fired twice. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about North Korea, and we've been talking about the escalating threats coming from that country and the U.S. response and how our diplomatic efforts have worked out thus far. We shift gears now because we want to talk a little bit about what daily life is like in North Korea. Our guest is Marcus Noland, an economist and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He's an expert on North Korea and has written a number of books on that country as well as South Korea. Marcus is the author of the Peterson Institute's blog, Witness to Transformation. Welcome to Radio Times.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Marcus, give us a sense. What is life like for the average person in North Korea today?
Well, you know, to use the old cliche, averages can obscure a lot. The North Korean economy works pretty well for a relatively small number of elites. For people who are among that elite, typically in the capital city of Pyongyang, if you look at their lifestyles now versus 10 or 15 years ago, clearly they're better off now. They have access to a much wider range of goods and services. As Joel Witt mentioned in the previous segment, there's this sense that Pyongyang is looking better these days. But for the bulk of the population in the hinterlands, in the provincial cities and in the rural areas, life remains very grim. Much of the population is chronically food insecure. Recent UNICEF survey found that 10% of the two-year-olds in the country are severely stunted. And stunting of that severity at the age of two confers lifelong physical and mental challenges. So it very much depends on who you are.
So, yes, the wealth is concentrated, it sounds like, with a very few, but for the masses, it's a different picture entirely.
Yes, indeed.
What about just the psychological aspects of living in North Korea? You've talked with many, many refugees from that country. Tell us what they've experienced psychologically. And obviously, we're talking about people who have chosen to leave North Korea, so there is a bias there. But what have you learned from them?
It's a really good question, and it's one that's really hard to really convey the answer. The first thing you have to start out with is that if you have people who are under the age of 70 or 80, frankly, they've grown up within the system, and they know nothing else. And this is a system in which the ruling family, the ruling Kim family, is literally deified. It is a society characterized by extraordinary degree of social control, a highly atomized society where there's very low levels of trust. And so even when people get into China, they will still express a certain amount of loyalty or admiration for at least Kim Il-sung, if not his son and grandson. In terms of psychological status of these people, we interviewed in one project I did about 1,600 refugees in China. Most of those people in a clinical setting would be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. They went through terrible deprivations in North Korea, especially during the famine period of the 1990s. And then once they're in China, they have no legal status, and they're subject to all sorts of abuse. Abuse by employers who don't pay them. Women are subject to trafficking and other sorts of sexual crimes. So many of these people, when they do eventually make it to South Korea, require significant amounts of mental health counseling.
What about health care, medical care? You talked about 10% of two-year-olds being severely stunted in their growth. What kind of access is there to decent health care?
Again, it depends on who you are. There is a hospital in Pyongyang that if you look at the statistics for that hospital, it looks like it has better medical performance than the city of Washington, probably the city of Philadelphia. However, if you go out into the countryside or the provincial cities, the socialist healthcare system, just like the socialist educational system, has collapsed. The reason is that North Korea has it has no real effective functioning tax system. It has no way to issue bonds. But it has a government that is maintaining a million-man army and many loss-making state-owned enterprises. So the state has an enormous need for resources and very little ability to raise those resources, so it resorts to the printing press. And inflation in North Korea runs on an annual rate of, say, 100 to 150% a year. So if you are a worker who is being paid, working for the state, and you're being paid a North Korean won-denominated salary, say you're a public school teacher or you're a doctor, you're being impoverished. And so what happens is in these provincial cities and in the countryside, families are just on the hustle because they have to try to get their hands on foreign currencies or real goods, which they can use to, in effect, bribe these underpaid teachers, underpaid doctors. In the case of the teachers, you want to pay your child's teacher so that the teacher will give your child good grades so that your child can move through the system and get properly credentialed. And in the case of the medical care system, if you want treatment, if you want drugs, if you want, you know, kind of a bed in the hospital, you have to pay.
So there's been a shift, it sounds like, toward this sort of criminalization going on in order to, hey, you know, I have to do what I have to do in order to get what I need.
Oh, you caught yourself with a bit of a laugh. There's no reason to do that. It is absolutely criminal. In the most recent cohort of refugees we interviewed in South Korea, of the women, and it's interesting, the market economy, there's a real gender dimension to all of this. The market economy that has risen up in the vacuum of the state's inability to provide is dominated by women. And of the last cohort of women that we interviewed that were involved in markets, more than 90% said that they paid bribes to policemen and others to avoid being shaken down. And on the and with respect to men, when we ask them what's the best way to get ahead in North Korea, something between 35 and 40% said engage in corruption and criminality. So it is a system that works well or reasonably well for a relatively small number of elites in Pyongyang, but for the rest of the country, it is almost Hobbesian in its kind of dog-eat-dog nature.
Let me invite our listeners to join us in this conversation. We are getting a glimpse inside life in North Korea, as told by a number of North Korean refugees who have been interviewed by our guest, Marcus Nolan. The number is 888-477-9499. Marcus, I'm just wondering, too, with things being the way they are and people now much more comfortable with resorting to criminal activity, if that's what it takes to get what they need, is there not also then a growing sense of dissent? Are people more, at least younger people, more suspicious of the regime as well? Or sort of politically, what are we looking at?
Again, that's a great question. And there really has been changes in behavior even since I've started doing these surveys. It used to be, if you interviewed people who left the country during the 1990s, you could ask them the following questions. Did you have access to foreign news broadcasts, typically through the radio? And you would have a certain percentage that said yes. And then you would ask the follow-up question, well, did you actually listen to those broadcasts? And the numbers would really drop. So there was this sense of inhibition. Well, what we saw as we did these surveys was that two things were going on. Number one, the share of people who said they had access to foreign news sources was rising. But what was really interesting was the inhibition was completely disappearing. So that by the end, the most recent surveys, you asked them, did you have access? Yes. Did you listen? Yes. There's nobody who's saying I had access, but I didn't consume. What's the most interesting thing that's come out in the last year or two in some of these surveys is I mentioned how atomized the society is and how nobody trusts anybody else. What we've now seen in the last year or two is people are consuming these illicit foreign news and a lot of it's entertainment, frankly. It's South Korean soap operas. But they're consuming them communally, which is really a breakthrough. It means people are sufficiently comfortable with this activity that they're not just hiding away under their, you know, the radios under their pillows, but they're actually all getting together, gathering around the television, watching South Korean DVDs. So that's breaking down. There is very little organized opposition to the state. In the few cases we've seen of organized or mass civil disobedience, it has almost invariably been over pocketbook issues where the state came in and tried to crack down on the markets, which is where people really make their money and that's how they survive. And because of the dominance of women in the markets, women are very prominent in these acts of civil disobedience. But it's all very reactive. And there's very little evidence, there's no evidence that I'm aware of really, that any of this is kind of ideologically motivated or beyond the kind of pocketbook issues is directed at the state in any deeper sense.
What about freedom of religion or lack thereof in North Korea?
There's complete lack thereof. There are some Potemkin churches in Pyongyang. Interestingly enough, Pyongyang was a center of Christian missionary activity at the turn of the 20th century and was known as the Jerusalem of the East. There is an underground Christian church and typically made up of small cells of people, maybe three, four people, who will gather and pray and hold services together. One of the results of this kind of fraying degree of social control is it appears that that this behavior is spreading and becoming more apparent. But I've had people tell me that even in a case where a family is Christian and son gets married to a daughter, they will keep the secret from the daughter-in-law for a period of years until mm-hmm. they believe there's enough trust there to allow, you know, to let her in on the
yeah.
secret.
Let's go to the phones quickly. Chris has been patiently waiting, calling from Ambler. Chris, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes. Am I on?
You sure are.
The nuclear technology and rocket technology are expensive undertakings. Where are the North Koreans getting their currency and materials exchanged to import the materials they need? Where are their physicians trained, their engineers, the electronic engineers, the nuclear engineers? Where are their chemists trained? Where are their space scientists and mathematicians trained?
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, that's quite a set of questions. So where do they get their money? Most of their money now comes through trade with China. About 80% of their trade goes on with China. North Korea is a very strange place. It's a bit of a 21st century hunter-gatherer economy. Basically, they trade minerals and some niche natural resource products like ginseng or marine products like sea urchins to the Chinese in exchange for consumer goods. Second source of money is something that was in the news today, which is the Kaesong Industrial Complex that they run with the South Koreans. And actually, I think the most dangerous signal in all of the stuff that's been going on is now the interference with Kaesong. That was sort of the goose that laid the golden eggs, and they'd be threatening nuclear war towards the United States, but they weren't interfering with the operation of the Kaesong complex. The fact they started doing so today is a very worrisome sign. The third source of money is illicit activity. The North Koreans are involved in counterfeiting, smuggling, drug trafficking, insurance fraud, all sorts of things. In terms of where they get their scientists and engineers, a combination of two things. They import a lot of consultants from Ukraine, former Soviet Union, and so on, as well as engage in formal cooperation with other states, including Iran. And then, like many socialist systems, historically, they were pretty good at math and science, very weak in social science and humanities and things like that. But they had a certain amount of homegrown scientific and engineering capacity. So if you take the homegrown stuff and you combine it with the consultants they bring in, plus the formal cooperation with some other states that are interested in similar sorts of research endeavors, that's where they're getting the human capital to operate these programs.
Thanks, Chris, for your call. You mentioned, Marcus, the Kaesong Industrial Complex, and we spoke about that very briefly earlier in the program. But that really is one of the markers, isn't it, that analysts are looking at, and there's a lot of concern now with them closing doors to South Korean workers. Do you anticipate that this is something that could go on indefinitely? Do you think it's just a sign of them flexing maybe for a week and then reopening as they've done in the past? What do you make of that?
Well, Tracy, in the opening, you described me as an expert on North Korea. And Vice President Mondale once told me that anybody who calls themselves an expert on North Korea is either a liar or a fool. So I try not to be, and my training is in economics, not psychiatry. And so when people ask me to predict future behavior of the North Korean leadership, I tend to shy away. What I think, but the point I made earlier, I think really is sort of the key point, which is talk is cheap. The North Koreans engage in a degree of invective that is simply unparalleled anywhere in the world. And me and a number of my colleagues have been astonished over the last week that suddenly that they're directing this invective towards the United States, threatening Washington with nuclear annihilation and so on. This is actually fairly standard for the North Koreans. It just isn't. It's normally directed at the South Koreans or the Japanese. And the fact that it's being directed at us now, you know, suddenly I'm on, you know, Radio Times. But it's don't look, you know, look at what I do, not what I say. And the Kaesong in previous episodes, even when things were going quite badly with the South Koreans, they didn't interfere with that because that was making money for them. There was one incident in the past, and I think this is very interesting about what's going on today, where they didn't. It wasn't that they stopped people from coming in; they stopped people from leaving, and they effectively held. My recollection now is about 600, it may have been 300 foreigners, almost all South Koreans, effectively held them hostage for about a week. So what's going on today is not good. But the fact that the interference is taking the form of stopping people from coming in but not blocking them from leaving is actually good because otherwise you could end up with a hostage situation up there.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I would think, too, that really shutting down any kind of activity up there ultimately would hurt the North Korean economy more than the South, right? And I'll have you answer very quickly because we have to go.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Well, Marcus Nolan, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times. Marcus is an economist and senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. We have enjoyed you sharing your insight into life in North Korea with us. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. And next hour, we're going to be talking about the airlines. Big news coming out of the airline industry in recent weeks, including the merger between U.S. Airways and American Airlines. Also, those air traffic control towers that are going to be shutting down probably in the next few days. We'll talk about that and more next hour on Radio Times. And on radio.